Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 291 of the Roguecast, recorded April 1st, 2020. Literally a bad egg.
Y'all might notice some weirdness in the sound quality this time out, because we are recording remotely. And also, we did have some technical glitches, so if there's any strange audio or if things just kind of cut off, that's what's going on. But we wanted to get a podcast out to you guys, and we hope to keep this going weekly. And now we'll get on to the show.
Welcome to our first remote Roguecast. We are coming to you from our homes because we are sheltering in place. The store has been closed for exactly a week as we write this. I am going slightly insane already.
I think you were going slightly insane on the first day.
I was. I've already been in there once. I'm going to be in there again tomorrow. We're doing a little bit of like calling subscribers, getting people to prepay for subs if they can, which helps us out. And people are calling in to buy gift certificates for when we reopen, which we don't know when that's going to be. When we closed, the shelter-in-place order was April 13th. I think we all knew at the time that was not going to be realistic, and it's already April 30th.
Yep.
We're going to be closed for a month. The store has never been closed for a week. The store has been closed for 2 days. So being closed for a month is really weird, and I don't like it.
No, yeah. I don't like it either.
That said, we should throw out a thanks to the support that everybody has shown us so far, which has been
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a huge day on the Tuesday. It was our last day. We had a ton of people come in. We had an almost free comic book day level of business, which for people who don't know, free comic book day is usually our best day of the year. And so that was a huge help. It definitely gave us a little bit of a cushion. And people really have come out to support us. People are supporting us. Nick started kind of a fun thing online to kind of keep people's spirits up and do something fun for the store. And that is our Please Marvel DC bracket fight about Rumble Royale that you're doing. So Nick, talk about that a little bit.
We used to do it for our old site, Comic Pants, when we were doing reviews. So I thought it might be fun to revive, to get people sort of talking about just comics in general, because I know we love these things. I mean, we love these characters. So it was just kind of a natural progression for my brain to go there. And yeah, now we're just fighting Marvel and DC characters every day, and it's something fun. It posts at 9 a.m. every morning, so we'll be doing it for a while. The new one just went up today versus Deathstroke versus Venom.
And it's alternating heroes and villains, and it's Marvel versus DC, right?
Yep.
And
this is somewhat prompted by Gail Simone's online call for after the crazy virus stuff for Marvel and DC to do a very rare nowadays team up.
Yeah. I really hope. I don't know how likely it is. I really hope they'll do it. I think it's possible. I mean, the thing that was keeping DC and Marvel at odds was that, like, Joe Quesada and Dan DiDio and Paul Levitz, like, all those guys, they really got into pissing matches during the Gemma's Quesada days, and I think they all decided they hated each other. But really, none of those guys were in charge anymore. DiDio's gone. No. Quesada's moved way up the ladder. And I don't think the animosity is quite as personal anymore. So it might could happen.
Yeah, and of course, it's complicated by their Hollywood ties and how much revenue superhero movies can bring in now. The pissing matches are extra hard, I guess.
I'm just thinking with, you know, the way that Hollywood is being hurt by COVID and comic companies are hurt, maybe this will sort of be a thing to bring them together a little bit and kind of maybe form a new alliance or something. Who knows?
I think that'd be great. I think one of our friends, Fathery, said that if Kevin Feige were to get on board, that would make a huge difference, and I think that's possible. If someone at the movie side gets on board, we could see it.
It seems a little unlikely, but we're living in unprecedented times. It is a method of coming together. It'd be pretty awesome.
We're living in a time where they're talking about releasing Black Widow, a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, on Disney Plus in the next month or so.
We passed unlikely a few months ago. 2020 seems unlikely. I'm hopeful for it, and I hope people enjoy. We had like 300 votes on that first day of Wolverine versus Batman, which, by the way,
it's insane.
Batman smoked Wolverine. It was like 65%.
I mean, that's the wrong vote, but that's what people voted for. So Batman will continue on, and poor Logan will, you know, go smoke a cigar somewhere.
last I looked, Venom was beating Deathstroke, but it was close. I don't know if that's still the case.
It's no, Deathstroke, last I checked at least, had retaken it by a few points. It's going to be a close one.
Okay.
It's going to be a close one.
It's a lot of fun, Nick, and I think it was a great idea, and I think people are enjoying it. So
good.
We'll post the full brackets when we get a little closer.
Yeah.
So, all right. So let's talk about the other news. There was actually other news in the world before all of this came down, which we never got a chance to talk about. Sure. And one of those is that Catwoman is pregnant.
Yeah, DC, that one got kind of buried because, you know, a pandemic.
Right.
But, she and Batman did not get married, but they're more or less living as though they were married, kind of.
Yeah, yeah, I think at the end of Tom King's run, they decided that they didn't need a priest, or they didn't need the legal documents to prove that they were together. They were just saying, we're together.
Yeah.
Plus, they didn't want to reveal secret identities. That's just so.
Hey, I have to quick ask, did Alfred give his blessing? Because that's really all I care about. I know he's dead right now.
It was
Alfred okay?
I actually think he did.
Last thing he said before Bane snapped his neck, he's like, I wish they'd be married, snap. That was it.
I'm just saying, if they were to get married, he should officiate and do all of that. But it's too late now, so they're just having animal sex in the mansion.
They can have him officiate Weekend at Bernie style.
Oh.
Tim, the ventriloquist can help out with that.
Oh, God, yes, but he can't pronounce his B's. Do you gruesome Mary Gratwoman?
Oh, man, that's messed up. But this means that Damian's gonna have a brother running around, or sister.
Yep. Yeah. Oh God, I hope it's a sister. Bruce Wayne has way too many boy kids.
It's true. That's kind of true.
Well, it should be Huntress, right? It should be Helena Wayne.
Oh,
yeah, I think
old Earth too.
Yeah, that would actually. I bet that's where they're headed with it. Some version of that.
And then she'll be force grown within a couple of years to a teenager. Somehow,
yeah. Do you think they'll do that?
Probably. Nobody,
because otherwise, but this is an opportunity to focus on something that we don't see too often, which is parents of newborns in having to deal with that for a few years. You know,
I didn't read the new Spider-Woman. Did they touch on that?
They did quite a bit, actually. Ex-porcupine villain Roger was her like nanny for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
as
far as like baby stuff, I think Spider-Woman is one of the few comics that's done it.
Hey, the pregnant Catwoman thing, did that actually happen like in a comic, or is this like something that is going to be revealed coming up?
Revealed in an upcoming issue.
Post-virus.
If I had to guess, it would be the Tom King, the Batman Catwoman.
Yeah.
12-issue series that he's got coming.
There was art. I read pages that had an excerpt from it.
You know, what would be interesting is if the Batman Catwoman miniseries is 12 issues, if they reveal it in issue 3, and then it's like 9 months of her being pregnant, or reveal it in issue 2, and then the baby comes in issue 11 or something like that.
That certainly seems like something Tom King would think about.
Yeah.
The sequence I read like a Tom King sequence, because it was a little off kilter and kind of a different approach. He's doing some kind of scans on her, like in the Batcave or something. I think she's probably been like sick or something like that. Mm-hmm. And she's like, it's cancer, isn't it? Or something like that. And he's like, no, no, it's something else. Anyway, it was kind of weird and sort of cute in its way. And I can see it being like, yeah, a page that they've released from like the upcoming Batman Catwoman thing. Yeah. So, you know, congratulations to him.
Yeah. Okay, so a couple bits of news have come out about The Mandalorian Season 2, which I don't know the status of this, if it was filming already, or if it's been delayed now, or, you know, if it was done. I don't know. My son is already asking me when Season 2 is coming out, and I'm like, boy, you have bad news for you.
oh, man.
But they've cast Rosario Dawson as Ahsoka Tano. So Ahsoka has now been in, like, every era. She's been in Clone Wars, Rebels, and now she will be in post-trilogy.
Well, I think this is because she is Dave Filoni's favorite character.
Yeah, I mean, I love Ahsoka. I have a friend who apparently does not. They were like, I'm sorry, I'm so dumb with Ahsoka, but good for you, Ahsoka fans. But
I was not loving her when they originally introduced her because they called her like the Snips, and it was very jokey. And that hour and a half long movie was hard to swallow.
I felt like there was promise there even early on.
Wrong.
Just because Nick hates teenage girls.
he's gonna hate force grown Helena Wayne.
But I will say this. She earned her, I think, accolades among fandom, because I think a lot of people were skeptical early on.
Yeah.
And then over the course of Clone Wars, they came to really like the character. And now she's, I think, one of their sort of foremost new characters, you know, created outside of the movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And
how old does anybody know, like, what her age would actually be circa, you know, post Return of the Jedi? Well,
isn't it like Clone Wars and Jedi, isn't it like 30 years after Clone Wars when Jedi ends, something in that ballpark? So
that sounds about right.
40.
So, I mean, you know, Rosario Dawson's age-ish.
Yeah. Yeah. He's about right. We'll see.
Well, and they just had an episode on the new season of Clone Wars that actually focused solely on her, which was really a fun episode.
There's like a little arc. The first arc was Bad Company, and it seems like then the second arc is all about Ahsoka being like an ex-Jedi, and I'm enjoying it. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah,
it's and great. Then the other news is that Michael Biehn is going to play another mercenary, which is great.
Man, that guy was like all over the 80s and 90s with Terminator, Aliens, Tombstone, and then he kind of disappeared.
This is Michael Biehn, isn't it? It's not Michael Biehn.
What's that?
This is Michael Biehn, isn't it? I just pronounced it Michael Biehn. It's just Michael Biehn. I think.
Yeah. Ballpark.
But yeah, you're right. He was like the go-to 80s action hero.
He's the Rock.
He's craggy now. He'll be like a mean, slightly older mercenary, I guess.
Maybe as long as he doesn't play that silly Terminator-looking bounty hunter from the comics.
Damn it, Nick! I was about to make that exact same joke. And I'm not sure
talking about the one from the Bounty Hunter comic.
Yeah, I don't want him to play that character.
Here's the thing, God, you should brace for that because they're bringing that character back in a big way in the Bounty Hunters comic. Like, I could see them doing it.
I know.
Oh man,
it's too on the nose.
That was, if I'm not mistaken, that character is from the old somehow from the Marvel run from back in the like early 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh well, maybe he'll just play Zax and the Bunny or whatever.
I would like him to play his character from Tombstone, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm good with that.
He was a great bad guy in it.
Yeah.
Didn't Val Kilmer kill him, though?
Well, I don't mean literally that character traveled through time backwards, I guess, since Star Wars was a long time ago.
Right.
But like that character.
Yes.
He was the counterpoint to Doc Holliday. He was also well-schooled and could speak Latin as well as sling a gun.
Yeah. It's true. All right, last bit of news. Ryan Reynolds is in talks to play Dirk the Daring in a live-action Dragon's Lair on Netflix.
That is Dragon's Lair, the old 80s video game with the animation from Don Bluth that was super hard to play but neat to watch.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't think I ever beat that game. I think I got mostly annoyed at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people who had a little bit of extra money and who could kind of learn the patterns and when it wanted you to jump through the door are the only people I ever knew who learned to play that. But I was super enthralled with it as a kid. I just endlessly would watch people play it because I was kind of, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, Disney's animation had not had its revival yet, and it was kind of on a downturn. Right. So I was kind of, as a kid who wanted to see that kind of lush animation, but maybe directed towards something cooler, before, you know, Secret of Nim came out, or I guess right around circa that same era. Maybe a little bit after then, they did Space Ace and Dragon's Lair, and I was so obsessed with them, I had trading cards, which I specifically remember buying on a family took a trip to Corpus Christi, and the gift shop and the hotel had it. So, like, every day I was like, could I have a dollar to go down and get some Dragon's Lair cards?
Anyway, he
seems like good casting for it.
I remember seeing it in the arcade. It was one of the first arcade games I saw where people had, like, there was a TV mounted above so you could actually watch it played.
Yeah.
And a few years back, they put it on iTunes, like on Apple, and you could buy it for $5 and play it on your phone. or on your iPad, and they had a cinematic mode. And I believe it was my oldest kid would watch. Maybe it was Aaron, my youngest, but they had a mode where you could just watch it through. You could just watch the whole movie.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
So they would just watch that when we were out at dinners or something. And when they were bored and they wanted something to do, they'd watch all Dragon's Lair. And I think they put Space Ace out like that too.
Yep.
But yeah.
By the way, I just remembered I also had a lunchbox of Dragon's Lair. So,
oh, wow.
So I wasn't kidding around.
Yeah,
I even watched the awful cartoon that they did of it in the 80s with really terrible animation.
Yeah, that was bad. Yeah,
I missed that one entirely.
Lucky you.
Yeah, there was a Space Ace cartoon too, wasn't there, with like the guy?
It was also awful.
Yeah, it was terrible.
I still watched it a bit, but even as a kid who was obsessed, I was like, this sucks.
Yeah.
But and, a friend of mine interestingly pointed out, he's like, in the cartoon or in the game, Dirk the Daring, the knight who goes through the treacherous castle of the dragon, is himself like a very straight character. He doesn't joke around, and Ryan Reynolds is known for joking around.
It's true.
But I think they'll probably try and give him some personality.
Yeah, I mean, mostly he dies in amusing ways. He gets those expressions in his eyes. So.
Yeah, it was a darkly humorous game.
Yeah.
Do you think they might incorporate that into the movie, where it's like, you know, you have a dozen lives to live, get killed occasionally.
Reynolds doesn't get burned alive, it's not fun.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. You almost want like a Russian doll kind of thing where he can see and then change and make different decisions. Like, I hope they do that kind of little bit of meta thing, because that is what make it work.
Yeah, I actually, now that I think about it, that could be like the special touch it needs. Although I think something that looked a little, had the brightness of the video game, but was live action, you know, kind of the way I'd say Aladdin was recently.
Oh yeah.
That alone could be kind of a fun hook, you know, give it some, if it has some punchy writing, Dirk as this kind of goofy, awkward hero, whatever backstory they need to invent with add to the character of Daphne, the girl he's trying to save, the princess. And maybe some of the other characters in it. I think they could find other ways to bolster it, but I do think a little bit of meta and different lives might be a fun concept.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so let's talk a little bit about comics. We haven't done the podcast in a couple weeks because pandemic. And
right.
So, but there have been comic weeks, and so we thought we'd each pick at least one comic out of those weeks and talk about them a little bit. We might talk about other stuff that came out. So we each have a pick of comics that have come out in the last couple weeks of March. Nick, why don't you start off?
Well, I'm going to obviously talk about an X-Men book, because that's what I do, and that's what I've been reading. And this one is Hellions number 1, which
I was wondering what you thought about that.
Yeah, I actually thought it was going to be awful, because it's a book that features Nanny and Orphan Maker and Scalp Hunter.
Oh, I thought you were Nanny Head. Isn't that what they call the nanny fans of Nanny and Orphan Maker?
No, I am not what you would call a nanny head. But this also has what's his name from the Hellions, Empath and Wild Child.
And can I just quick ask, is Nanny a little egg-shaped robot?
Yes.
Okay, so just checking.
Can I quick make a point before we get into Hellions?
Yes.
I don't remember if it was Alan. I don't know if it was Alan Moore. Somebody once said every character is someone's favorite. Does this mean that somewhere in the world someone is like, ooh, fuck yeah, Nanny and Orphan Maker are back?
I like that you lump them together, because you can't Nanny or Orphan Maker. You have to like them both.
That's even better. What if there's someone who really loves Nanny and hates Orphan Maker?
I think
egg-shaped mom robots, but I cannot stand badass assassins.
You know, Randy, I think that in our world, that person, even in our world, the whole world probably does not exist. But in the infinite multiverse,
yes,
there is an Earth, probably where there's no pandemic, but there is somebody who's a fan of Orphan and Nanny Maker.
And in that multiverse, Watchmen was actually a 12-issue Nanny and Orphan Maker miniseries.
Oh, God.
By Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons.
Okay, now, this is a reinvention. The Hellions were like the Hellfire Club equivalent to the New Mutants back in the 80s, but this is a new version of it, so tell me what the idea is.
So the idea behind this one is that these are all the kind of bad eggs of the X-Men universe right now. I know, I went for the
literally.
Literally a bad egg.
And basically, instead of like sending them into their, I forget what exactly it's called, but their black hole, people that they get, they put in prison, essentially.
Oh, I didn't know that they had a phantom zone.
Yeah, they have one in the depths of Krakoa, and the only person in there right now is Sabretooth. Because Sabretooth
is worse than Apocalypse.
Yeah, like, Sabretooth can't kill as many people as Apocalypse. He's not that efficient.
Yeah, but Sabretooth, like, after the creation
after
of
the armistice,
the new Krakoa actually, yeah, like, killed some, like, humans, so that was against their rules, and they threw him down in the pit.
Into the Phantom Zone with you.
So
these are the, but these are the people who are still troublemakers, but they're not in the hole.
Right, these are the misfits, and for some reason they decide to give Sinister his own team. Because
this is Sassy Sinister, right?
This is Sassy Sinister, yes.
Okay, just check.
Running his own team with Psylocke as sort of a kind of arbiter for Cyclops on the team, kind of like watch over them.
Okay.
So yeah, it's kind of weird. I wasn't expecting to like it, but Zeb Wells is an interesting writer. He's gotten better over the years. And this is sort of...
He has been doing a lot of fun stuff with the D&D comic.
Yeah, this is him sort of bringing that same kind of mentality that he had when he was writing Thunderbolts. However, okay, this is kind of bolstered because the art is so much better on this than it was on Thunderbolts.
Yeah.
I forget who the artist on that one was, but this is Steven Segovia, and it is actually really, really pretty. It opens up with, like, it kind of won me over on page one because the first sequence has Siren involved in sort of an altercation with, like, a new Splinter faction going after mutants. And it was just cool to see her, but it's just a lot of fun concepts.
What is the team doing? What are they doing with these people?
It kind of goes through each one is, like, what they're doing. Like, Empath was, like, projecting different emotions on people, causing like fights on Krakoa, and like people to go after.
He should be down there with Sabretooth. That's messed up.
He's not killing anybody. Nanny,
just taking over minds. That's all.
Yeah, Orphan Maker is going insane because they were keeping him apart from Nanny. Who else is involved? Wild Child's just insane. Scalp Hunter is, you know, Scalp Hunter. He's the
but, like,
only.
What are they using them for? What are they like? Go, are they like trying to, or do we know yet? Are they going to say, like, we, you
well, like
are bad
said,
people, go
like
do
said, this,
this and mess somebody else up?
The first issue is sort of the formation, kind of like the whys and why are they together and that. Their first mission
Havoc
is
Havoc in there?
Havoc is in there because they're still doing that stupid idea of him going insane through that axis. Do you remember that axis where he had like a.
Oh.
The Red Skull changed up like people's brains.
Wow.
Oh, that was when they had like evil Tony Stark and stuff?
Yeah, that's when they had evil Tony Stark. So they're kind of still messing with Havoc being changed from that, which I really hate because I love Havoc. He's like my favorite Summers character. But yeah,
but you liked enough to not be put off.
Right, right. Yeah. Now, I mean, any idea given to a writer that has some chops can make it work. So Zeb Wells actually kind of uses it to some good here, at least for good story purposes. And yeah, they're sent to, they're basically sent on a new mission that they run up against a old X-Men villain from the past, which I don't want to spoil because it's actually a really cool one. But yeah, like I said, this is sort of getting the team together issue. There's not a ton in the way of like, this is what's going to be, but there's a lot of character interaction, and I really enjoyed that.
I usually like the getting the band together stories.
Yeah.
What you're saying is, it sounds like, is that the X-Books, even with like a new launch, like a year or something into it to them?
Are we a year? No.
Or is it half a year? Because they were putting out two issues sometimes.
I think it might be a year. I don't know, it's been a while.
If nothing else, it feels like it's been a little bit, but I know that also, like, House of X and Powers of X kind of blur into it, so.
I did like there's one scene that has Scalp, they're going after, Scalp Hunters on Krakoa, and the members of the Morlocks are really pissed off that he is still there, and they're kind of, Callisto is going
some of them.
Callisto is sort of going after Scalp Hunter, which I thought was a nice little callback to X-Men history. But yeah, he is the only original Marauder on Krakoa. So I don't know. This is a fun issue. I liked it. I want to see where it goes if and when we get issue two.
Dave, you want to talk about the Marvel's ill-timed launch of their big crossover?
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, the interesting thing about this, and the pick is called Road to Empire, number one. I think it's just a standalone.
It's Road to Empire Kree-Skrull War.
Oh, yeah. And that's Empire spelled with a Y for whatever reason, because I don't know, is it supposed to look like funeral pyre, maybe?
Maybe.
That's what it looks like. Well, I know that just from our behind-the-scenes talk that I don't think any of us were, like, looking forward to a big crossover, which I knew that involved Hulkling from the Young Avengers, who's part Kree and part Skrull, like, either sort of uniting the Empires or, you know, some Game of Thrones type of War of Succession or something like that. I wasn't exactly sure, but I was just, like, not looking forward to it.
Yeah, Dave, I think you and I were both actively skeptical of this. We were like, oh, man, why are they doing this?
And then I, at the very least, I read this preview issue, and I was like, oh, I really like that.
Me too. It was really good.
So now I want the pandemic to hurry up so that, among other things, I can read the rest of this.
Yeah.
Well, who wrote this intro?
What's that?
Who wrote the issue?
So the issue is written by Robbie Thompson. Oh, and, okay. Remind me, who's Robbie Thompson?
Robbie Thompson wrote Silk, and he was a Supernatural writer.
Okay, yeah. That's a solid pedigree then.
Yeah.
So what the framing device for this issue is, and what it essentially does is through flashbacks and talks, you get a recap of the Kree-Skrull War and some related stories, some of Marvel's cosmic stories from the 70s, primarily, as they're reflected on by the Warners. The Warners are the Skrull infiltrator family that was spotlighted in the recent comic Meet the Skrulls.
And that was also written by Robbie Thompson.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm excited when something can make me excited for another project, and yeah. Now I want to read that. I know that y'all had said it was a pretty fun book.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was basically the Skrulls by way of the show The Americans. It was really well done.
Right, yeah. They're like a family Skrull infiltrator unit. And I remember I don't remember who the artist was on the series, but I remember liking the art on
it. I want to say it was Javier Rodriguez who did the History of Marvel Universe.
He does the flashback scenes in this, and I adore his art.
He's great.
He's like my MVP of Marvel right now. And it's weird because I know he's like doing nostalgic sort of stuff, and I guess that's triggered to appeal to me, but I actually don't have a big fondness necessarily for 70s Marvel. I'm more of an 80s guy. But, like, I feel like he should draw all flashbacks forever. And in any case, this issue caught me up on what was going on with that Skrull family who's had some losses. Notably, the husband was killed recently, and the family is sort of on the run, sort of having, like, a safe house in a hotel. And they're still waging their war, but the kids, there's three daughters, and they're starting to show some skepticism about the Skrull mission. And so over the course of discussing it, as sort of new events and threats prompt the discussion in their battle with the Kree and their attempt to kind of stay ahead of the authorities on Earth, they flashback and you see these crazy 70s scenes of like that basically retell the origin of the Skrulls, their initial confrontations with the Kree, the wild story from the 70s with the Mantis when she was revealed to not something that's been in the movies yet to be the Celestial Madonna.
This is the first time I've understood the Celestial Madonna story, by the way.
What's that?
This is the first time I've ever understood the Celestial Madonna story.
Same here. It always seems so bonkers to me, and it is, but this made it sound bonkers in that kind of cool way that I'm like, oh, I do kind of like how comics are wild.
I feel like this is one of the things, David, you and I have talked about this before. You can get kind of lost in the weeds going back and like explaining how all this retcon stuff makes sense, but you can also do a thing where you can streamline it and make it a better story. And I feel like that's what Robbie Thompson did here. It's like, oh, he made the Kree-Skrull War, which has always been like this patchwork thing of people throwing things, seem like a through line. And I thought that was a really strong accomplishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's like, at some point, they're talking about like the Celestial Messiah that was supposed to be born from Mantis, and I guess that character had been used in some of the recent stuff with the Thanos and the like the Cancerverse and all that.
Right.
And they mentioned that, and so one of the daughters is like, yeah, but the prophecy didn't come true. And one of the other kids is like, oh, maybe we're still like, maybe the prophecy is still unfolding. And I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting that, you know, the notion that they feel like they could still be living through it. And, you know, he just hasn't like ascended yet or whatever. Let's see. So between the framing device story has like painted art that's really nice and shows the family and is this kind of cool, you know, family on the run story. And the flashbacks are just amazing by Javier Rodriguez. So yeah, I couldn't have been happier with Road to Empire. Words I never expected to say.
That's, I know, crazy. I really wish I had gotten a chance to read this one.
Well, and that's the thing. I think it reminds me a little bit of how we first got into Annihilation. We were like, oh, this looks interesting, but you know, I don't know if we're like into a big cosmic crossover. We all wound up loving Annihilation Conquest. Yeah. And this feels like that.
The stuff with like the, you know, the Young Avengers, which I am also like, I like the Young Avengers, but I'm kind of not, I'm only tangentially a follower of them. But yeah, the stuff with Hulkling as the person who could unite the Empire and will play a big role in this, it also gets a flashback and is also drawn by Javier Rodriguez, so he gets to draw some modern stuff too. And yeah. And I'm interested to see how it's all going to play out. So yeah, I think, you know, one way or another, this, a lot of this has already been done, and I'm sure will be you know, after we get through this craziness, we'll find its way out. Yeah. So I have every confidence that I will get to see the story. I just have to be a little bit, I have to wait now.
I have a small question for you, Dave.
Yep.
Is Wiccan with Hulkling? Like,
we only see side flashes as the kids talk about who Hulkling is and his, how he was raised and thought he was a mutant at first and all that stuff. But yes, you do, you see him with Wiccan, but you don't see any, like, here's what his current status is. This is really, in a lot of ways, a recap of the, okay, the, like, who he is. So yeah, it's not contemporary as to, like, what his current status is.
Okay.
My pick is a weird one. Marvel is doing this sort of 25th anniversary celebration of Marvel's, the Kurt Busiek, Alec Ross story. Mm-hmm. And, they did a hardcover collecting the original story. And then also Alex Ross is collaborating with Jim Kruger, his creator on Earth X, to do something called Marvel's X. And he's doing something called Marvel that is sort of a weird side sequel to Marvel's.
And I think that Alex Ross had always wanted to, I think, tell more stories where creators could be turned loose to just tell stories from Marvel's history. And he wanted, I guess he always wanted Marvel's to be a broader project. Is that, yeah, right?
And it seems like maybe that's what he's getting. I have no interest in that. The Marvel X and Marvel is not really doing much for me. But the other side of that is that they're doing these thing called Marvel Snapshots, which is Kurt Busiek bringing in other writers and artists to do stories from Marvel's past. And I didn't have a lot of interest in that because I thought, well, even though I like the creators involved in it, I was like, well, I don't know if there's really room for a retro series right now. But the first two stories have been really good. The first one was Namor, mm-hmm, which I talked about a couple weeks ago. And the next one, the one that just hit this last Wednesday, was Fantastic Four, which is focused on the Human Torch. And it's written by Evan Dorkin and Sarah Dyer, the married couple who do a lot of stuff. Art is by Ben Dewey, who is the artist on Autumn Lands and Beasts of Burden, and has sort of a cool painty style usually. And based on these two one-shots, I'm probably going to pick up a trade of all this when it comes out. I'm really interested in them so far, and I would recommend it to anyone who has any interest in Marvel history. But basically, the pitch here is Kurt Busiek is doing Astro City, but in the Marvel Universe.
Okay, that's pretty good.
Because the story is about sort of the side characters and how people are affected by. So the first one was Namor and his longtime girlfriend. This one is also, it's the Human Torch and his original girlfriend from the small town Midvale, I think, wherever he and Sue grew up. And yeah, it's about like a sort of reunion where the Human Torch comes back into town and his ex-girlfriend is sort of giving interviews, and there's a news crew, this little small two-person news crew that's going around looking for the story. And it seems like everybody in this town kind of thinks Johnny's a hothead and a jackass, and they're like, yeah, he's this big famous guy now, but you know, he was a nightmare. He hot rotted around everywhere. He was a playboy, and they're sort of, everybody's talking about, and they're talking to his girlfriend about it. And there's a twist that I don't want to give away, but basically it's all about sort of like how this celebrity superhero had a completely different reputation in this small town that he grew up in. And
what effect that actually sounds really interesting.
It's really good. And it's, like I said, it's a very Astro City story.
Sometimes what I like about story, the people who have a love for the Marvel history, like, you know, whether it's Mark Waid or Kurt Busiek, is that they'll take something that I'd kind of, has been a little bit lost, like the, like that, the, was it Midvale that you mentioned?
Yeah.
That, like, they, you know, that's not story, something that they probably tend to think about going back to, but there's an interesting, you know, like, as is apparent, there's an interesting story to be told there. And, you know, it's a way of building on that Marvel history without sort of paving over it sometimes.
Right. It's a lot of fun. And like Wade's recent History of the Marvel Universe project, I'm like, I don't know if there's an audience for this, but there was. And so
yeah,
one for Marvel Snapshots as well. If you happen to be one of those people who are in that audience, I would recommend these.
Nice. I have not read it, but I'm definitely going to check it out.
And usually we would go now and talk about other stuff that's come out. And I'm going to quick throw down a few things. I don't know if you guys have anything on your list, because it's been a couple of weeks.
I have a few things to mention.
So I want to mention Transformers versus Terminator, which is Dark Horse IW. It was a fun idea of that one. I like the way they did it. And it's one of those things I enjoyed. The Resistance number one, which is part of a new publisher that Bill Gemmis and JMS are involved in somehow. JMS is writing it. It starts as a global pandemic that causes superpowers, which, wow, not great timing. But it's an interesting first issue. Did any of you guys read any other ones that came out of that one? Archangel 8 or any of the other ones?
I didn't. Just the busyness, I didn't get around to it. And when I was making signs for them, that I was like, oh, these actually all have premises that sound interesting to me.
Suicide Squad, which four issues in, seeing. Tom Taylor may be a guy who just doesn't launch strong, because I think Deceased was one of those where I'm like, I don't know if I really like this, and now I love it, and I'm loving every bit of it. And I liked Unkillables number two quite a bit too. But Suicide Squad number four, they've flipped the script a little bit on what it is. He's doing something different. I like all his characters. And there's a great...
And he made Captain Boomerang super cool in it.
Oh man, this Captain Boomerang stuff is so much fun. That was really good. I think the only other stuff for me, I want to mention Immortal Hulk, kind of like a double-sized issue that was like a big issue of that. And I'm continuing to think that's one of the best books Marvel's putting out right now. And then Blade Runner came out, and that was another issue where I'm like, I'm really enjoying Blade Runner.
I need to catch up on that. It's the second arc has been getting pretty interesting. So,
anything else on y'all's pile?
Nick?
I mean, I'll just mention like, Wolverine number two, series continues to be really good. X-Men number, I think, 9 came out, continuing the whole Brood storyline, which I thought was fun. The second issue of Giant Size X-Men, this one focusing on Nightcrawler, with art by, I believe it was Alan Davis.
Yeah, that was. I saw that had, among other things in it, the old Sidri Hunters from the Shi'ar. They're sort of little mercenary insect things.
It was a really cool idea that the Sidri had basically taken claim over the old X-Mansion. And that was sort of their base of operations.
Huh. Yeah, and there's just flipping through it, I saw there's kind of a big character reveal by the end of it. But yeah, they had like kind of created a creepy nest in it while everybody was off on Krakoa. And that's kind of a fun callback, because way back when Paul Smith was drawing the X-Men in the early 80s or mid-80s, Kitty fought a bunch of the little Sidri in the tunnels underneath the X-Mansion.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a super awesome story. And so, but yeah, I guess they were still around.
Yeah, I just want to shout out that Alan Davis draws a hell of a Nightcrawler.
Oh, yeah.
That really makes sense.
Yeah.
Dave, what else you got?
I got just two or three others I want to quick mention. The latest Ninja Turtles comic, the issue 104 from Sophie Campbell's run on it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say, after several issues of the team being very fragmented, they all come together in this one. They form a game plan that I really like to sort of try and honor their fallen mentor, Splinter. And that sets up a kind of a cool new status quo in the cordoned off mutant section of the city now. And it was really nice to see. It's a very emotional story. But it also it sets up some cool stuff that that I'm going to, I'm looking forward to, like, basically the next arc of it. And I know that our staffer, Anna, will probably be excited to see that the Turtles go out to catch a heavy metal concert. there was a new Judge Dredd miniseries this week. Not the biggest Judge Dredd fan. This is from IDW. But it actually has a premise that when I read through it, I ended up really liking. You've got a guy who's it's told from the perspective of a guy who is not Dredd. And that's interesting because Dredd is more of a force of nature in it. He's like a courier of like illegal stuff in the in Mega City 1, but he was a washout judge who like knows how some fighting and stuff because apparently they teach you to beat people up on day one. but he washed out and now he's like very much an outlaw. And he's delivering this package that happens to be amidst a frenzy being rung up by a super anti-immigrant xenophobic nut bar. And the interesting thing is that Dredd is sort of in the middle of this. And, you know, Dredd is like, you know, broadly speaking, always that kind of fascist conservative type person. And he's got to the comic I know doesn't want to cast him as being on the side of xenophobes. So you do see from his perspective, this guy is as dangerous in like riling up Mega City 1 citizens with xenophobia. He sees him as dangerous as a criminal. And he's clearly, they're going to play a role. And I suspect he's going to have to end up working with this courier guy who I really like. But anyway, it's a cool, there's also a big cool chase sequence with Dredd after this guy in the tunnels under Mega City 1. It's off to a good start. And you know, as always, poking at some relevance for sure.
Okay. Huh. It's interesting.
Last thing I wanted to mention was, just real quick, was a book from Vault called No One's Rose, which is about some survivors. They call it solar punk, I think was the term they used. Survivors of an ecologically devastated Earth living in a sort of last biodome that sort of keeping it going. And yeah, it has kind of like a punk sci-fi style within that setting. It looked, the art looks good. I haven't read it yet, but it's on my to-do list.
We are back for part two. We are going to be talking about TV because one of the things you do in a pandemic is watch a ton of TV.
Yep. Yeah. You think Netflix engineered this?
I think, I'm giving a little bit of sideways glance. Yeah, I think it's possible.
It's. I'm just saying. I saw that Outbreak is trending there.
Well,
it's on Netflix's top 10, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you can't tell me the Tiger King didn't have something to do with the pandemic in some way.
Yeah, it sounds like that could be the logical trickle down.
Yeah. Let's start with Tiger King, Dave. Did you get a chance to watch any of this?
I did not. I only know it through it has infused my Facebook page and. Oh, yeah. It's there's memes around it, and I don't mind spoilers, obviously. I have some sense of its craziness because it sounds like that crazy Fire Festival documentary, but about zookeepers, I guess.
It is crazier than Fire Festival, if anything. It is. You think you have a sense of it, but it's crazier than you think it is. Because, Nick, you've watched it, right? Did you watch all of it?
Yeah, I watched all of it in one sitting.
How long is it?
Seven, I think it's five episodes.
Seven.
Is it seven? Okay.
Yeah, seven episodes. So yeah.
So I spent 7 hours straight watching it.
So this is is the story about people who own illegal tiger and lion zoos. Well, no, they're
that
not.
Sounds depressing.
I was gonna say
they're not supposed to be selling and breeding tiger cubs, but
correct.
They do keep the animal abuse stuff to a minimum. There's a little bit of it, but they mostly keep that to a minimum. Mostly it's about the crazy personalities of these people. This could easily just be about people running weird businesses and having weird rivalries. Like it could be about car salesmen. It's the tiger stuff is there, but it's not about animal abuse. But our lead, as it were, is a guy named Joe Exotic who lives in not Florida, or is he Florida? No.
I'm going to guess that's not his birth name.
It is not his birth name.
No, it's not. So as a quick aside, and it comes up in the actual documentary itself, but I remember Joe Exotic from a while back. And Dave, if you've watched John Oliver, you will remember this as well.
Oh.
Because he was the guy running for governor or whatever.
He was running for office. And then for governor. Yeah.
Yeah. And when that finally came up, I was like, holy shit, I remember this.
Yeah. Yeah, Joe Exotic is this guy who he's basically a gay, polyamorous, redneck tiger aficionado.
Yes.
And
that's a you just hit a random name generator thing.
Yeah, he has
a random RPG character generator of some sort.
During,
he's also a half orc.
During the course of this, he has three different husbands, two of which at least are straight.
Yeah.
And who
I've
are,
heard about that.
And who are clearly into him for the big cats and the meth.
Yep.
So that's one character. There's a sort of con man who comes in and takes over his zoo. There's another guy, Doc Antle, who's been on like Jimmy Kimmel, and not Jimmy Kimmel, the other guy. No, it is Jimmy Kimmel. No. Who's the
Craig
guy?
Ferguson?
Who's the guy on NBC?
Craig Ferguson.
No.
The other Jimmy Fallon?
Jimmy Fallon. He's like Fallon and all this. And he's a guy who brings tigers and stuff. I think he's been on the Letterman's Late Show. He's this guy who runs a big cat zoo. And also,
you mean his big sex cult zoo?
Yeah, he has a sex cult of women that he clearly like groomed as teenagers, and then they became his sex slaves and workers of the zoo. It is fucked up beyond all belief. It is so weird.
That's super nuts.
Yeah,
and I like that he came out.
I have a quick ask. The way this is a documentary, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I assume that like it's not. Although I'm sure there's plenty of footage of them. I assume that like the various scandalous goings on were not necessarily like filmed. And this is what, interviews after the fact with participants and stuff?
Yes and no, because also like these guys are all idiots. And so they all just give interviews and talk about things. Also, Joe Exotic was doing a reality show. And so they have a ton of footage from that.
I guess the nature probably of our sort of YouTube era is that people are somewhat, I think, they like to talk about themselves. If it's probably in a shady light, there's something, I guess, cathartic and narcissistic and ego-fulfilling about talking about yourself.
And one of the other main players, Carol Baskin, runs this, like, big cat rescue that's basically a cat zoo, but she claims to be more ethical about it.
Well,
and
so ethical that she killed her husband.
So ethical that she probably killed her husband to fit him for tigers.
oh, my goodness.
But she's like does a YouTube show where she gets on and she's like this mom. She's like, hey there, all you cool cats and kittens. Here's what's going on in our zoo. So like there's tons of footage of all these people.
Oh, wow.
And they're also sure they're in the right, that they will totally give interviews about everything.
I mean, her little society is a cult too. I mean,
yeah, well, yeah, she's got
shirt color designations based on how long you've been in the cult.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Crazy shit, and
that sounds weirder than like Boy Scouts stuff.
it is bonkers. I've had a few people on my feed who are like, "This is too depressing. I can't watch it." But for me, it was such an entertaining train wreck and such a distraction. Very much like the Fyre Festival thing, where I was like, "Man, there's no good guys here. I feel bad for the poor young kids who got dragged into all this." But the main players, like some people, are like, "Well, you're just making fun of the mentally ill here." I'm like, no, these people all chose this life. Like, they've had their time. They're all old enough to know better. I don't give a shit what they're going through right now. It does end with murder for hire and jail time. It does the thing where it does big reveals at the end of every episode. And they keep it reminds you a little bit of the recent HBO show McMillions, but it's crazier than that. Like, it is worth a watch.
Did I hear it was based on a podcast initially?
Oh, I think that's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I heard it was like probably one of those sort of the same way Serial would break down something. But yeah. I heard it was a really good podcast before this, and then they adapted it.
It reminded me a lot of the Netflix Making a Murderer TV show.
For sure. Yeah.
Well, and also I think I may
get around to checking this out today.
I would recommend it.
What else am I going to do? It's a pandemic.
Well, so take this for a grain of salt, but I've heard that Kate McKinnon wants to do a live action show around this, and she wants to play Carol Baskin.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Which I want because I love Kate McKinnon. So, and she will be amazing saying, "Hey,
I have already seen
all you crazy cats and kittens."
In addition to all the memes, I've seen people do goofy like dream casting of this on social media.
Oh, yeah.
And pick what actor would play what ridiculous personality and everything.
Yeah,
it's a moment in time right
now. You're going to get another level out of those memes once you've seen the show. It's on another level. It's amazing. Okay, let's jump over and talk about something very different, which is Star Trek Picard wrapped up its first season.
Yes.
Dave, you've of course been talking about it every week because you have Tech Trek, your podcast.
Yeah, we timed it out so that it was our 100th episode was the Picard season finale discussion.
That was a good idea because there wasn't anything else going on at that time that was worth
it. You know, it's funny because a few weeks before crazy pandemic hit, yep. We had been experimenting with, instead of doing the show live, we'd been testing out doing some streaming stuff just to save us on time so we didn't all have to get together in the same place at the same time. As it turns out, that was prescient, and it was good that we had the technology in place.
Yeah.
So we had to do it that way. But, Now, I had somewhat mixed feelings about it. It reminded me a little bit of Lost in the finale because I'd been loving, like, the sort of buildup. But the last two episodes or so, I didn't kind of love all the plot thread stuff, like how it all came out. It felt a little bit forced in places. But there was the emotional payoff was pretty strong, and I ended up pretty solidly happy with it and definitely loving big parts of this of the run.
That's kind of where I come down to. I it's got its flaws. I feel like it's weird that a story arc that, like, they had pre-planned all this and they knew where they were going felt a little bit more like an old school network show where, like, just things kept happening where I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't quite line up with what you did before. Like, detail wise I feel like there was some stuff that didn't quite line up right, but I loved all the characters. In broad strokes, I really like the story. There are a couple notable decisions that were made. Hashtag don't kill Hugh.
For real.
But in general, I really like this. I go back and forth on whether or not I like it better than Discovery, which I really, really love. And that to me means it was mostly a success for me. Nick?
Yeah, when I think about the best stuff I liked about Discovery, whether it was Pike or the Mirror Universe stuff or Harry Mudd, and like, so, there's so many good things in there that I really do love about Disco. But Picard, I think its highs might have been a little bit higher for me.
Yeah.
So and absolutely nostalgia plays a role. So I think I maybe slightly prefer it, but it's a toss up. Nick, where'd you land?
I enjoyed it, but I think I lean on the side of it's kind of messy at times.
Yeah.
And while I love the Riker stuff, and I actually really liked what they did with Data. And sort of the final stuff that they had with Picard and him. I thought that was very moving. I couldn't kind of buy it wholeheartedly. Like, just the season. If there was too many things I didn't care for. Especially killing Hugh. I mean, that was I just rewatched all of Next Gen, and I really liked Hugh. And I thought the scene with Picard meeting Hugh was fantastic in this season. And then just the next episode, they're like, nope, he's dead. And I was like, damn. Just
they had a cheat villain who unfortunately never proved to be a great villain.
No.
Died, and that villain died so cheaply as well. I mean, kudos to Seven of Nine, but still.
Yeah, and that was one of the, like, among the high points. Seven of Nine has been great.
Mm-hmm.
I've ended up liking most of the new characters. I like Rafi, Captain Rios. Dr. Jurati got to kind of come into her own.
Yeah, I like all the new characters.
Yeah, I think where they left all the characters are fantastic. I think they did a great job sort of that. It's just some of the other stuff was really weird.
I think Star Trek as a concept, since it's, you know, usually been about, in a way, sort of spreading, you know, the enlightenment of Federation values, it somewhat resists, I think, the format of a lot of TV shows that are like sort of genre TV, which is, you know, that big build up to some final confrontation with a villain.
Yeah.
A lot of Trek movies do that. And that works pretty well in the framework of like a 2-hour story. When you've got like a 10 episode season or something like that, and you're trying to make everything line up for some big finale, even though that's not really kind of what Trek is best at doing, it's, or even what it should be doing, I kind of think. That it feels a little awkward. Like, I feel like I would have seen this problem with the synthetics and their question of their rights and their humanity. I think it would have been resolved, or like it would have been explored in a more meaningful way in a 1 hour episode of Next Generation.
Yeah.
I think I just fall on the side that I like Disco a little bit more. I think what they did with 10 episodes felt like a more cohesive story.
It felt
their
bigger.
Their finales have been a little bit messy in Discovery as well.
That's true.
I guess I'm looking through rose-colored glasses on that, because I did. I think I just enjoyed the characters a little bit more.
No, that's fair. I really like the characters in Discovery, and I'm looking forward to, of course, the pandemic wrapping up so I can get back to Tilly and Saru and Burnham and all of the rest of those guys, too.
All right, that'll do it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more, and until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com, and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.